Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Inflation, rising interest rates, volatility. Whatever markets have in store, a financial advisor can help. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 9th of October. The Israeli military says it's regained full control of towns and villages overrun by Palestinian militants from Gaza. Israel's defense minister has ordered a complete siege of the Palestinian territory after carrying out hundreds of airstrikes. The latest reports say 700 Israelis and 560 Palestinians have been killed. We'll bring you up to date. Also in the podcast, food, tents and blankets have started arriving in villages hit by a strong earthquake in Afghanistan. How climate change is affecting tourism in popular destinations like Spain.
The temperature used to go down a little bit and we have a little rest at night. But this summer, for 20, 25 days, that didn't happen. So maybe in the future we will have way more people coming to our destination in the winter and autumn.
And the old coins found in Scotland, which may have belonged to a clan chief who was murdered more than 300 years ago. More than 2 days after the murderous assault by Palestinian militants, the Israeli Defense Forces say they've regained control of the towns and villages that were overrun. However, some Hamas gunmen are reported to have entered southern Israel overnight through tunnels from Gaza and may still be at large. At least 700 people in Israel died in the attacks, including at least 9 Americans. 100 people were taken as hostages across the separation barrier. The health ministry in Gaza says 560 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. Israel has called up 300,000 reservists as it gears up for a possible major military operation. Israeli Defense Forces spokeswoman Masha Mikkelson says their immediate focus is on rescuing the captives, whatever the cost.
Israel is a state that holds human life sacred, and we will do everything in our power to ensure that they're coming back home safe. But we're at war. What military target was Hamas going for when they murdered over 700 people in the last 48 hours? This is the deadliest attack on the state of Israel since its formation.
74-year-old Ada Sagi is among those believed to have been kidnapped by Hamas near the Gaza border. Her son, Noam, lives in the UK.
It feels unreal on so many levels. It feels inhumane on another level. It is very upsetting to think that this is even possible, that, you know, that even in war there are rules. And we're talking about men in their 20s and their 30s that come into an old woman's house and snatch her and her neighbors. So I am seeing life a little bit through the keyhole right now. And I want to see Mom coming back home alive and well.
Well, for the latest on the Israeli military's efforts to restore security in southern Israel, I spoke to our correspondent, John Donison.
It's a somewhat confused picture in that area around Gaza. We've just had a statement from the Israeli military spokesperson, Daniel Hagari, and he has said that Israeli forces are now in full control of the communities that were attacked by Hamas. But there might still be Palestinian militants at large in the area. Now, earlier the army had said that there remained fighting in 7 or 8 separate locations. The military has also said it believes that Palestinian militants were able to breach the fence and pass into Israel overnight, with some reports of a tunnel being dug. So it does seem that the southern border is not yet completely secure, although the military is saying that those communities are now under its full control.
Meanwhile, the defense minister has been making some strong comments about Israel's response to this attack.
Yes, Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said he has ordered a total blockade on the Gaza Strip with no electricity, no food and no fuel. Of course, Israel has had a blockade on Gaza along with Egypt since Hamas took control back in 2007. But it does seem that that is going to be tightened. And it's already an incredibly difficult situation in Gaza. We've had Israel targeting 500 Hamas targets overnight, it says, and the UN saying more than 120,000 Palestinians in Gaza have left their homes and have been displaced. And many of those are sheltering in UN schools.
And 2 days on from the start of this assault, how do people in Israel feel? We've heard that sirens have been going off in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem where you are.
Yeah, we just had a siren go off here in Jerusalem a short while ago, apparently because some more rockets had been fired out of Gaza. I think, look, Israel is in a state of collective trauma. I mean, just to put this into some sort of perspective, in previous conflicts, back in 2009, you had 13 Israelis being killed. In 2012, it was 6 Israelis being killed. Now we're talking about more than 700. This is completely unprecedented. It came as a surprise, and many Israelis are angry at what's happened, but they're also pretty united, I think, in that it needs a strong response from the Israeli military and the Israeli government.
John Donison in Jerusalem. And as John was saying, the Israeli Defence Minister Yoav Gallant ordered that the long-term blockade of Gaza be tightened into a total siege, with even water supplies cut off. "We are battling beastly people," he said. Najla Shawa is from the charity Oxfam in Gaza City. With airstrikes continuing, she told us that even before the attacks, life for Palestinians in Gaza was harsh.
"Since yesterday morning, we had no electricity whatsoever at our house. Now, because it's good to remind people who are listening that before the date of October 7th, Gaza was suffering. Palestinians have been suffering. So electricity for 15 years has not been proper. I mean, it's 6-8 hours a day. And this affects also the entire water system and access of water to houses. That was an airstrike, probably in the area. Yeah.
Well, the situation in Gaza is currently too dangerous to broadcast from. But a few hours before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to our correspondent in the Palestinian territory, Rushdie Abu Alouf.
I can see huge black smoke and dust on the sky covering the entire area. The sound was really very loud and very shocking in the area. That was the situation since last night when Israel started the second day of revenge into Gaza. About 500 airstrikes targeted many places, many locations across the Gaza Strip. One of them was a deadly attack in southern Gaza. As the health ministry said, 19 members of one family, they all killed under the rubble of one house targeted in Rafah and southern Gaza, where now the funeral for those people are about to take place. Hamas official here in Gaza issue a warning that keep the border shut will mean that all of the essential services cannot be provided for the people within 48 hours. They held like a press conference this morning. They said we are running out of fuel. Hospitals are running out of the essential needs. They said we need the border to be open immediately so we can send those who are in critical situation to be treated in better hospital, maybe in Egypt. So the situation is really escalating, mounting the escalation in a very serious way, very dramatic way since last night, with the sound of explosions could be heard everywhere.
Yeah, the UN saying more than 100,000 people have been displaced. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, telling people in Gaza to leave. Is there anywhere they can go?
No way. I mean, the Gaza is 2.3 million people. They live in one of the highest densely populated places, maybe in the entire planet. And people have no shelters. They have no even, like, you know, a siren system that warns them when there is airstrikes. Some of the people fled to UN school, but the UN schools can't take all of the people. Also, some of the Israeli IDF spokesman was advising people to go into the city center instead of staying next to the border. But even in the city center, we have seen many buildings collapsed and from our bureau in the middle of Gaza City. I'm overlooking the Gaza downtown, and there is three or four buildings were taken down, and they're blocking the main road. So many people have been like appealing on local radio station, saying, where can we go? How can we hide? When there is 500 airstrikes around Gaza, the presenter was talking to locals who were appealing on the local radio station.
BBC's Rushdie Abu Alouf in Gaza. A Hamas spokesman has claimed that Israeli airstrikes overnight and today on Gaza had killed four Israeli hostages as well as their Hamas captors. There's been no confirmation of that, but the BBC has seen video footage that appears to show the dead bodies of at least three hostages on an Israeli road near Gaza who were filmed being taken away on Saturday. There are also reports that Qatar is trying to broker a deal under which Hamas would free Israeli women and children in exchange for Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Our correspondent Anna Foster is in the southern Israeli city of Ashkelon, just north of Gaza. I asked her about the Israeli military build-up there.
What I can see is that a large number of Israeli military vehicles, their guns are trained towards Gaza. In some cases, they appear to be in a sort of ready-to-move formation. Now, there are a lot of things that Israel has to consider right now in terms of a ground offensive and whether it's something they want to do. They know that there are hostages, Israeli hostages, that are being held inside Gaza, and that is a consideration because it is so densely packed, densely populated, as Rushdie was telling you there, to actually go in and carry out a ground operation with minimal civilian casualties, both on the Palestinian side and to Israeli civilians who are being held hostage, would be extremely difficult. But they do need to try and rescue those hostages. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, has promised a substantial response to those attacks in the early hours of Saturday morning. That would look on paper like a ground offensive. So I think at this stage, everybody is watching and waiting to see what will happen here next.
There are reports of rocket fire coming out of Gaza, as well as Israeli airstrikes going in. How does it feel there?
Well, it's been happening all morning. And in fact, we were in the centre of Ashkelon interviewing somebody just earlier. And often on your mobile phone, people have apps that will actually sort of let you know when there are incoming missiles. But in this case, the public sirens went off and people who live there, they know what that means. So we, along with them, we went and took cover and literally looked up above, and you can hear the loud banging of those missiles from Gaza that are being intercepted by the Israeli Iron Dome missile defence system. It does manage to catch most of them. They say more than 90%. But then we saw smoke rising on the horizon. So we went to an apartment building where a missile had fallen. It was right outside, actually. It was between two buildings, and you could see the crater in the ground. We went to one apartment where the shrapnel had sort of blown up and pierced what looked like bullet holes in their windows. The family were obviously extremely frightened. I talked to parents who were cradling their children next to broken windows. To reiterate, they are used to this kind of thing happening. They are used to a certain number of missiles being fired from Gaza. But what they are seeing at the moment, they say, feels relentless.
Anna Foster in the southern Israeli city of Ashkelon. In a separate development, the Israeli army said it had killed a number of armed suspects who had infiltrated into northern Israel from Lebanon. A Hezbollah official there said the group hadn't mounted any operation into Israel. Well, as we've heard, Israel is massing its forces around Gaza, and many Palestinians are bracing themselves for further retaliation. Our analysis editor, Roz Atkins, has this assessment of the fast-moving events of the past few days.
Let's start with the Islamist militant group that carried out this attack. Who are Hamas? Well, its name is an Arabic acronym for Islamic Resistance Movement. It's sworn to Israel's destruction, and its base is Gaza. It's been in control there since 2007, though, as it's not held an election since, it's hard to gauge what support it has. This weekend, President Biden called Hamas a terrorist organisation, and the EU, the UK and the US all categorise it this way. In the region, Iran is Hamas's primary backer. Hamas also has close relations with the militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon, which shares a border with Israel. Our next question is whether this weekend is different to previous escalations. Serious violent escalations between Israel and the Palestinians are not uncommon, but the scale of this Hamas attack makes it different. Israeli territory was infiltrated. Over 700 Israelis have died. As many as 100 hostages were taken. And the UN's Middle East peace envoy says this is a dangerous precipice and I appeal to all to pull back from the brink. This is different. And the scale of the attack leads us to how is Israel responding? Well, already Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talks of a long and difficult war. There are Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. At least 400 people have been killed. Military vehicles are heading to the Gaza border and tens of thousands of Israeli reservists are being called up. As well as that, the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has announced that additional equipment and resources, including munitions, will be sent. Israel's allies are offering solidarity and help. And while right now the focus is on the immediate threat from Hamas, Israel and its allies will also know that in the long term, this attack will reshape how they seek to maintain Israel's security.
Ros Atkins. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Our 12-year-old sister was hoping to become a doctor, but is hopeless about her future. I was delighted when I saw the Dars advert and decided to make sure my sisters watched the program.
The multimedia educational series aimed at girls in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, rescue teams have begun to deliver essential aid like food and blankets to villages destroyed by a powerful earthquake on Saturday. The 6.3 magnitude tremor flattened areas in the western province of Herat, and the death toll continues to rise. I got an update from Dawood Azami, head of the BBC Afghan service.
It's a remote area far from the capital, Kabul. So that's one reason that it's taking a lot of time for aid agencies and the central government to carry out rescue operations or deliver aid. But we are getting reports that entire villages have been razed because they are mostly made of mud bricks, not very strong buildings. And most of the people who died in the earthquake are women and children because they were at home. Men are usually outside in the farms or for work. So they were at home, so that's why they are buried under the rubble. And many people are still buried under the rubble. And the reports we are getting about the death toll is that it is reaching 2,500. And it will go up, I think, because they are finding more and more bodies and thousands of people are injured. There are not many hospitals. Hospitals are overwhelmed. So there is a need for medicines, for shelter, for food, for everything you need to survive. Today, the deputy prime minister of the Taliban government visited the area to assess aid delivery. But the Taliban government has made several appeals from aid agencies and international community that we need aid, we need medicine, we need food, we need everything.
Yeah, because even before this, the Taliban government was struggling with the economy. It's a very poor country.
It is one of the poorest countries in the world. There are UN agencies which are mainly involved in humanitarian work, but the UN itself was asking the international community even before this earthquake that we need aid desperately because the winter is coming, a lot of people need food to survive, but this is an additional challenge that they are facing. So it will be a big challenge for the Taliban government, especially because they are now in charge and they are expected to deliver, but also for aid agencies as well. There are some Afghan businessmen inside the country and outside Afghanistan who have pledged aid, but it will take many days and weeks to arrive. And if you look at the comments made by Afghans speaking to the BBC or on social media, they are criticizing international response or indifference because they say that it is saddening and people or the international community is not responding quick enough. And the news of the earthquake was obviously overshadowed by what is happening in Israel and Gaza.
Dawood Azami of the BBC Afghan Service. Well, staying in Afghanistan, a BBC educational programme aimed at children who are barred from school has launched its second series. DARS, which means lesson, will run on radio, TV and online until the end of the Afghan school year in December. Helena Wilkinson has been looking at its impact.
A lesson in maths delivered in Pashto, one of the languages of Afghanistan. Since the programme launched 6 months ago, the team has been tracking its impact. Here are some of the messages from the audience, read by a BBC journalist.
Our 12-year-old sister was hoping to become a doctor, but is hopeless about her future. I was delighted when I saw the DARS advert and decided to make sure my sisters watched the programme.
DARS ba man omid midehad. DARS gives me hope. I was wondering if there are people out there that care about me. Now I know.
The programme is broadcast in both Dari and Pashto, Afghanistan's two national languages, and includes stories from around the world and lessons in science and English.
School. I go to school.
It's presented by BBC journalists who were themselves evacuated from the country.
Hi, my name is Alia Farzan and I'm presenting DARS. As I was in the country a few weeks ago and I witnessed that people were very happy about this, especially those girls and the parents, that the girls couldn't go to school and they didn't have any other help during this period.
Yeah. Tell her that I removed it.
I've come to the gallery where the team is in the middle of recording the programme. The presenter is Shazia Haya, and she's in the studio next door to us.
Salamuna.
It's vital for us. My cousins are in Afghanistan. They are not able to go to schools. And they have grown up and seeing me as a lady who had opportunity to go to school, who had opportunity to go to university, and now who has the opportunity of working.
Fiona Crack is head of World Service Languages. She says it's particularly difficult to get any accurate measure of the programme's impact.
What we do see is the response from the girls, from the children, through our social channels, telling us it's making a difference to their lives.
Pashtana Durrani campaigns to improve the lives of women and girls through her educational charity, Learn Afghanistan.
That's such a brilliant and brave thing to do, especially when you don't have a political position to do it. And you just do it, not wait for somebody or your country or the political system to change. That's the biggest allyship that anyone could do with Afghanistan right now.
Huge numbers of children in Afghanistan can't go to school. The DARS programme may be one of their only avenues to education.
That report by Helena Wilkinson. This year, many parts of the world suffered unbearably hot temperatures, with southern Europe particularly badly affected. There are concerns that as the impact of climate change becomes increasingly obvious, it will affect the EU's $600 billion a year tourism industry. Guy Hedgko reports from Benidorm in Spain.
Europe's hottest ever summer may be coming to an end, but in the beach resort of Benidorm, the sun is still shining.
27 is absolutely fine. I mean, I'm burned from head to toe, but that's just by the by, isn't it?
Too hot during the day, yeah, unless you're actually in the pool. You know, obviously the only respite you get is in the hotel room where you've got your aircon.
You just need to be able to feel a bit of the heat into your bones. Other than that, if it gets too hot, you can't go out in it.
In Mediterranean countries, climate change is starting to be felt in the tourism industry.
We used to have a way smoother nights. The temperature used to go down a little bit and we have a little rest at night, right? But this summer, for 20, 25 days, that didn't happen. So maybe in the future we will have way more people coming to our destination in winter and autumn and not that much in summer.
Temperatures are increasing in the Mediterranean region 20% faster than the global average. Here in Spain, there were four heat waves last summer, during which temperatures exceeded 40 Celsius in many areas of the country, as the authorities recommended that people remained indoors during the hottest time of day.
Italy saw record temperatures over the summer, and wildfires caused thousands of people to be evacuated from islands in Greece.
La semana ha empezado con calor, pero las temperaturas van a ir subiendo con el paso.
The science suggests these are not freak weather events.
La tendencia para los próximos años.
The tendency over the coming years will be longer summers, starting earlier and finishing later, and we will have longer, more intense heat waves.
The possibility of extreme heat seems to be influencing where many holidaymakers go. Since the pandemic, cooler destinations like Denmark and Iceland have been particularly popular.
We are seeing a gradual but sustained trend that people are travelling more to the north of Spain and to northern Europe, and this will continue.
It's still too soon to know the full impact of climate change on tourism, but it could be that southern European resorts like Benidorm will soon face stiff competition from places where the sun doesn't always shine.
Guy Hedgeco in Spain. A hoard of coins hidden under a stone fireplace in Scotland has been found after 330 years. They're believed to have belonged to a Highland clan chief murdered in the massacre of Glencoe in 1692. The coins were discovered by an archaeology student on her first ever dig. Our Scotland correspondent Alexandra McKenzie reports.
The archaeology team from Glasgow University said this was the first major excavation in Glencoe. The dig focused on scattered rocks, believed to have been the MacDonald clan chief's summer house. More than 300 years after he died in the Glencoe massacre, an archaeology student taking part in her first ever dig found the hoard. The University of Glasgow said the discovery contained 36 silver and bronze coins, dating from the late 1500s to the 1680s, including pieces from the time of Queen Elizabeth I and King Charles I. It's thought the hoard was hidden just before or during the Glencoe massacre for safekeeping. A number of other artefacts were also discovered at the site, including a musket and fowling shot, pottery from across Europe, and a powder measure.
Alexandra McKenzie. Returning now to our top story, the escalating conflict in the Middle East. The attack by Hamas militants is a huge challenge for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. His right-wing government has deeply divided the nation over its sweeping legal reforms, and his political opponents are blaming him for failing to keep Israelis safe. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen spoke to Martha Carney.
The recriminations have already started in the anti-government newspaper Haaretz. There's a coruscating editorial, of course, condemning what's happened, the attacks, but also saying that the person who's faulted is Netanyahu, the prime minister, because he's been so concerned with his own legal problems. He's on trial for corruption. He's been concerned as well with the very ideological nature of his current government in trying to take over areas of the West Bank. So on that side, there are already arguments about who is responsible. Now, I don't think there are any arguments among Israelis about what they should do next in terms of taking military action.
And the military action could include a ground operation, which would be very significant, given the ground forces were withdrawn, weren't they, in 2005?
Yeah. Israel occupied Gaza fully, the whole of it, until the early 90s when the peace process started. But they still retained a large area of Jewish settlements where there were soldiers. They were pulled out in a unilateral action in 2005, not part of a peace agreement. And one of the reasons why, up to now, the Israelis have tried to contain Hamas in Gaza rather than go in, as many people have called for on the Israeli side, to settle the matter, as they put it, once and for all. One of the reasons is that they don't want to get into an occupation again. The occupation was very difficult for them. Gaza is a strip of land along the Mediterranean coast, but it has a population of around 2.4 million people. So fighting in that area will guarantee large numbers of civilian casualties. And if they try to put troops on the ground in a long operation, they'll probably get a lot of Israeli casualties too.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. If you'd like to submit a question for an upcoming special edition all about the escalating Middle East conflict, send us an email or a voice note. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you can find us on X or Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and mixed by Craig Kingham. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.